right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, September 18th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Monday, everyone. It is a warm 68 degrees and partly sunny here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show Brain Internet, BMI, as in Brain Machine Interface, EEG, EMG, neurons, AI, mind monitoring, and Internet of Things. And I have to say thank you to the 132 listeners we get on the show on Friday. That's pretty awesome. We covered a lot of crazy things about new ways for them to tap into our neurons and be able to remotely control devices such as keyboards or mice, monitors, and some of the new technologies that are being rolled out as part of this 21st Century Cures Act that had a whole section about brain illness and illness monitoring. And we have all kinds of new products. We read about that emotive little headband that you could put on, and they have full dashboard statistics. And one of the experiments that they want to do is to put anyone who wears one of these devices utilizing an EEG to put their readings online for research, of course, and for anyone who wants to see them. And it's got to be very concerning, because as this technology is rolling out and they're able to wirelessly connect, as they start understanding all the chinks in the human armor and how the brain works and how the body works and how the environment works, they are able to put supercomputing power behind some of these technologies to be able to crack secrets that they never thought before possible. I came across an infographic yesterday titled "The Evolution of Brain-Computer Interfaces. Imagine a world where machines can be controlled by thought alone. This is the promise of brain-computer interfaces using computers to decode and translate human thoughts into machine commands." Here's a look at the evolution of brain-computer interface technology, its current state, and its future prospects. Types of brain-computer interfaces. Number one is invasive. Signal-transmitting devices are implanted directly into the brain's gray matter. This method produces the highest quality signals, but scar tissue can build up and cause signal degradation. They show a couple different heads and brains and how they put these little devices in there. Then there's the next one is partially invasive. Devices are implanted within the skull, but not within the brain tissue. Produces higher quality signals than non-invasive techniques by circumventing the skull's dampening effect on transmission, and it has less risk of scar tissue buildup. And last but not least is the non-invasive. This involves simple wearables that register the electromagnetic transmissions of your neurons with no expensive or dangerous surgery needed. This is just one of those little skull caps. This technique is certainly easier, but suffers from poor resolution caused by the skull's interference with the signals. So a short history of brain-computer interfaces. 1924, a German neuroscientist, Hans Berger, discovered neural electrical activity using an electroencephalograph, which is an EEG. 1970, our best friends, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, begins to explore the potential of brain-computer interface applications of EEG technology. 1998, the very first brain implant produces high-quality signals. 2005, a monkey brain is successfully used to control a robotic arm. And then 2014, and we covered this on the show, direct brain-to-brain communication achieved by transmitting EEG signals over the internet. Types of non-invasive brain-computer interfaces. Number one is eye movement and pupil oscillation. Now, interestingly, we just covered a story the other day about a smartphone application that is coming to be able to gauge head injury by your pupil oscillation when you use the flash on your smartphone to stimulate your eye. Also, electroencephalography. Number three, magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, and magnetoencephalography. Applications of brain-computer interface are direct mental control of prosthetic limbs. Neurogaming, which is interacting with a video game in a virtual reality environment without the need for a clumsy interface. All you have to do is think about it. And we covered a story on Friday about them playing video games just with little twitches of their fingers as researchers had discovered how to hijack the brain signals going to the musculature of the arms. And then last but not least, we have synthetic telepathy, which is the establishment of a direct mental connection or communication pathway between minds. And that's some of that Hive technology that they are working on. Use of the brain-computer interface in telerobotics will allow human operators to directly link with robotic machines, which would be granting us a new way to explore alien worlds, which would be like MechWarrior, connected via your mind and virtual reality. Also, handling dangerous materials and how to perform remote surgeries. Let's just not have a connection issue. The wealth of new possibilities for interfacing with computers opens up, including linking to the internet, uploading our memories to the cloud, etc. Just like Kurzweil's What Dream. And it will effectively erase the divide between the disabled and the able-bodied. Of course, it's all in the name of curing you. So that was a brief history of brain-computer interfaces. We found out on Friday that good old Georgie Porgy Church, the one who is leading the charge on CRISPR, who's also involved with the Weiss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard University, is a consortium between Harvard and MIT, announced a cross-institutional consortium back in January of 2016 to map the brain's neural circuits with unprecedented fidelity. And this is his new method called FISSAQ, fluorescent in situ sequencing, to be able to pretty much barcode each of the neurons in the human brain and build a map as to how it all works. The consortium will leverage the Weiss Institute's FISSEQ method to push forward neuronal connectomics, which is the science of identifying the neuronal cells that work together to bring about specific brain functions. Yeah, we also have another group, and this is the Argonne Labs, Supercomputing Labs. Supercomputing is allowing us to map the brain function at the deepest level. A pair of researchers from the U.S. Department of Energy's Argonne Labs wants to map all the neurons and connections in the human brain. To make this happen, they are enlisting the help of advanced supercomputers. Humanity has so much to gain from the map of the human brain's neuronal connections, but while producing maps sounds simple enough in theory, it is extremely difficult in practice. Our brains have some 100 billion neurons making 100 trillion connections, and mapping this massive amount of information requires that we pinpoint the exact location of every single neuron before we can even hope to understand how they communicate with one another. I wonder if George Church's little project with IARPA, that is the intelligence agency's DARPA, to map the human brain is going to take a part in that. Taking a team approach to this task can make it slightly less daunting. And that's exactly what two researchers from the U.S. Department of Energy's Argonne National Laboratory are doing with their new brain connectome project. Researcher Doga Gursoy is an assistant computational scientist at Argonne Advanced Photon Source, while other researchers, Bobby Kasuri, is an Argonne neuroscientist. The goal of their joint project is to fully map the human brain, but first, they are starting relatively small by mapping the 75 million neurons in the brain of an adult shrew mouse via a combination of data mining and machine learning. Enabling this process is Argonne's new 9.65 petaflop Intel Cray supercomputer called Theta, and housed in the Argonne Leadership Computing Facility, that is equipped with an advanced and flexible software program designed to work with big data problems. Now, I also read that there was an IBM supercomputer in that same lab somewhere, too. The basic goal is simple. We would like to be able to imagine, to image all of the neurons in the brain, but the data sets from x-rays and electron microscopes are extremely large. They are at the tera and petabyte scale, says Gerzoy in a press release. So we would like to use Theta to build the software and code-based infrastructure in order to analyze that data, to map the deepest levels of neuronal connectivity and activity in the tiny mouse brain. Gerzoy and Kisfude first need to produce the data that Theta will later analyze, and this will be accomplished using Argonne's electron microscopes and a high-resolution 3D imaging technique called X-ray microtomography. Once the high-resolution images are taken, they can be fed into Theta, and the analysis produced by Theta's supercomputing powers will provide an image of the mouse brain in depth never before explored. Machine learning will go through these data sets and help come up with predictive models. For this project, it can help with segmentation or reconstruction of the brain and help classify or identify features of interest. After they complete their analysis of the adult shrew mouse's brain, Gerzoy and Kisfude plan to move on to the brain of a larger mouse and then maybe a non-human primate. And while the technique won't be ready for the complexity of a human brain for some time now, once it is, the implications could be tremendous. Now, how insane is this? To be able to map a brain in extreme ad nauseum detail. Remember, they're creating those little mini brains. Well, there's a new story, September 7th, 2017. Human skin cells, and those are those iPS stem cells, can be transformed directly into motor neurons. Scientists working to develop new treatments for neurodegenerative diseases have been stymied by the inability to grow human neurons, motor neurons in the lab. Motor neurons drive muscle contractions, and their damage underlies devastating diseases such as amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is ALS, and spinal muscular atrophy, both of which ultimately lead to paralysis and early death. In new research, scientists at the University School of Medicine in Washington, the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, had converted skin cells from healthy adults directly into motor neurons without going through a stem cell state. It's a little bit different. The technique makes it possible to study motor neurons of a human central nervous system in a lab. And unlike commonly studied mouse motor neurons, human motor neurons growing in the lab would be a new tool, since researchers can't take samples of these neurons from living people, but can easily take skin samples. Avoiding the stem cell phase eliminates ethical concerns raised when producing what are called pluripotent stem cells, ding ding, which are similar to embryonic stem cells in their ability to become all adult cell types. And importantly, avoiding the stem cell state allows the resulting motor neurons to retain the age of the original skin cells, therefore the age of the patient. Maintaining the chronological age of these cells is vital when studying neurodegenerative diseases that develop in people at different ages and worsen over decades. Going back through a pluripotent stem cell phase is a bit like demolishing a house and building a new one from the ground up. What we are doing is more like renovation. We change the interior, but we leave the original structure, which retains the characteristics of the aging adult neurons that we want to study. Well, guys, all this study of neurons and neural activity is not going to end up good for you and me, though it may cure some future diseases. It also gives them all of the secrets that make you, you, and me, me, and allows them to manipulate different behaviors of the brain and different functionality. I was just reading something the other day about them wanting to make it like a remote control, and this is out of Photonics Media, photonics.com, making the connections, optics, neural activity, and behavior. Fiber photometry and fluorescence microscopy bolster optogenetics research into how the brain works. So we've talked about optogenetics before. There's a lot of military technology and research going into that as well. An international army of neuroscientists, ding, is trying to better understand the inner workings of the brain by exploring the correlations between neural activity and behavior of freely moving or partially restrained lab animals. The best method for neural activity control activation or silencing of opsin expression neurons is optogenetics, and the prevalent optics-based methods for monitoring the neural activity of fluorophosphorescence-labeled neurons are fiber photometry and head-mounted fluorescence microscopy. Neuroscientists appear equally divided over whether fiber photometry of fluorescence microscopy is the more appropriate method for monitoring the neural activity revealed by excitation of specific fluorophones. But there is no such division regarding optogenetics and its control over neural activity by light and optics. Now, I'm reading this because there is something disturbing as we are seeing more of these electronic devices and applications rolling out into the mainstream. And we remember years ago them talking about being able to use cycles per second in the 60 hertz range, like from different displays that we look at now, to be able to do flashes of light. You read about the science of optogenetics, and now that we have fiber optic high definition connections to everything, soon to be with all and 5G and the Internet of Things, you have to really wonder, as this research is continuing, they are finding ways to flip neurons on and off using flashes of LED fiber optic light. And we have all these new LED devices, LED screens, high definition. It's just going to make you wonder where this is going to lead in the future. Remember, your eyes are connected directly to the brain through the optic nerve. Optogenetics uses light to activate or silence cells labeled with genetically encoded light-sensitive proteins or opsins that are coupled to an ion channel. And when the light-gated ion channel absorbs the light of a specific wavelength range, it changes its configuration and it lets ions flow into the cell, modulating its activity. Ding, ding. By expressing opsins in a specific population of cells, these cells can become responsive to light signals and can be controlled with light. The most popular opsins are channel rhodopsin 2 or CHR2 and helorhodopsin 3 or NPHR3.0. And when blue light, which is anywhere from 450 to 473 nanometers, activates the CHR2, a nonspecific station permeable channel opens and the depolarization of the cell occurs. Guys, this is using light in a specific wavelength, blue light, 450 to 473 nanometers. And I'd be very interested if that's the same frequency of blue light that comes from our devices, activates a certain opsin protein or whatever it is in the brain. It makes a change to some of your brain cells. The light-gated chloride pump, NPHR3.0, is activated by yellow light at 595 nanometers, and it allows chloride ions to enter the cell, causing a hyperpolarization of the neuron or its silencing. The opsin activation light-powered threshold is a few millimeter waves for blue and up 20 nanometers, meter squared for amber light. And the direct measurement of neural electrical activity in freely moving animals is very difficult because of its fast time scale and the low sensitivities of available sensors. But for these reasons, it is beneficial to use an indirect approach. Calcium fluctuations at the cellular level relate to an underlying electrical activity and can be measured using fluorescent genetically encoded calcium indicators. Variations of fluorescence indicate changes in the calcium concentration, revealing cellular activity. So they can have a direct effect on cellular activity in your brain using light. Now, this brings up an even more interesting story that I ran across this weekend. Published September 14th, 2017 in BigThink.com. There are biophotons in the brain. Is something light-based going on? Over the last 100 years, scientists have realized, first in rats, that neurons in mammalian brains were capable of producing photons or biophotons, as they call them. The photons appear, though faintly, when visible within the visible spectrum, running from a near-infrared through violet between the 200 and 1300 nanometer scale. The question is why? Well, in biology, of course, why is an iffy question that presupposes intent, that is, of some conscious designer at work. In fact, many traits just are due to random mutation and have simply never been selected out. It's unknown so far if biophotons just are, but scientists have some exciting suspicions, and a recently published paper asked a tantalizing question. Are there optical communication channels in the brain? And if the answer is yes, then what is being communicated? The very notion opens the conversation to a whole other level of operation in the brain that could be a previously undiscovered entangled quantum level. Ding, 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 ding. The team wanted to know whether or not there existed an infrastructure over which light could travel from one place to another in the brain across the distances required, focusing on myelinated axons. Axons are the fiber that carry the neuron's electrical signal outward, and myelinated axons are covered in myelin, which is a fatty substance that electrically insulates the axon. They modeled such axons doing computations on how light would behave as the fiber bent, lost, or gained thickness in their biophoton, absorbing myelin coating, or how they would behave when crossing each other. The team concluded that the light conduction across myelinated axons is feasible. The axons could pass between 46 and 96% of the light that they received over a distance of 2 millimeters, which is the average length of a human brain axon. But the percentage depending on bending, sheath thickness, etc. And they also worked out that though rat brains can pass just one biophoton per neuron a minute, human brains with many more neurons could convey more than a billion biophotons per second. Now think about that one. Altogether, the researchers conclude that this mechanism appears to be sufficient to facilitate transmissions of large numbers of bits of information or even allow the creation of a large amount of quantum entanglement. So there's what could act as an entire network for light-based communications in place, but we don't know what, if anything, it is doing. Well, come on, now you have to believe that something like this didn't just happen by accident. And as we discover back a few weeks ago, we read a story about the photon. The photon can live forever. And as we look, what's micro is macro. And what is out in space is exactly the chemical elements that make up what we are here on Earth. It has to make you wonder if it isn't just one big ecosystem. And if we aren't just red corpuscles in some larger living organism, it's a pretty interesting thought. Maybe we are just light that somehow has become matter through resonance and frequency. And someday we'll just go back to little photons that float around the universe and look for a new home. I don't know, guys. After you have a couple instances where you almost bite the dust, you start thinking about these things. And then when you start seeing all these little research dots connect, they make you go, huh? The researchers proposed a set of in vitro and in vivo experiments for others to perform that could confirm their findings. Meanwhile, did they say entanglement? Well, given the presence here of photons and the possibility has to cross one's mind, since they go hand in hand, as it were, with entanglement. In the paper, the scientists are intrigued in particular with the interactions between photons and nuclear spins, the way the nuclei turn causes different chemical effects, and how that affects things like magnetoreception in animals. And given that there is some distance between the biophotons and the nuclear spins, the scientists wonder if there is entanglement involved, saying that for an individual, quantum communication links to form larger quantum networks with an associated entanglement process involving many distant spins, the nuclear spins interfacing with the different axons must interact coherently. This most likely requires close enough contact between the interacting spins and the involvement of synaptic junctions between the individual axons may provide such a proximity mechanism. And since some people think entanglement could be behind whatever process it is that produces consciousness, well, where is that going to lead? And you have to admit that is a pretty intriguing question. So as they are messing around with optogenetics and photons and little flashes of light that we find out can actually affect cellular processes within the neurons, it's got to make you wonder what their intentions are in the end. We found out as part of that 21st Century Cures Act, there were billions of dollars that were being dumped into the Obama Brain Initiative. And the Brain Initiative, they hope by 2025, they have a scientific vision planning documents calling for a budget that reaches $500 million a year by fiscal year 2019 for a total 12-year budget of $4.5 billion. Although future budgets are quite uncertain, the National Institute of Health anticipates awarding $195 million for fiscal 2017, which includes projects that investigate brain cell types, tools for cells and circuits, technologies for neural recording and modulation. Ding, ding, ding. That's what that emotive was doing and putting it in a dashboard. Also, the understanding of neural circuits. Now, speaking about this, I came across a company this morning. Their name was Thomas Recording. ThomasRecording.com. Go under products and then under neuroscience products. And I seem to have stumbled upon their Mad Science Gone Mad Lab. They have a whole bunch of different sections under neuroscience products. The first is accessories, and there's all kinds of little pointy tweezers and, I don't know, little clampy things. Number two is amplifiers. Number three is chronic recording devices. When you click on that link, you have a little implant with some leads on it that says primate. And then you have another one that has a picture of a mouse or a rat with a little thing embedded on top of its head called small animal. Chronic recording devices. So this would be of implants for neural activity. Number four is data acquisition systems, 16 channel systems with a little external box and some software with a whole bunch of different tracks, 16 tracks of brain waves. We also have eye tracking systems with some robot googly eye cameras. We have another section called micro drives, which are little embeddable hard drives, it looks like, that get embedded right into your skull or somehow implanted on top of your head. The next section is called microelectrodes. We have single electrodes, tetrodes, heptrodes, array electrodes, multitrodes, cluster electrodes, and then manufacturing equipment. We have another section called micro-injection systems, which looks like it would be a way to painlessly inject something like this into your gray matter. We have a next section called optogenetic products, and that would be equipment for optogenetics. Optogenetics electrodes, and we've talked about those before. Those are little fiber optic cables, and then optical fibers. We have another section called screws. They look like some sort of bone screws, and there's four different types with hex heads and Phillips heads. And then there's a whole software section, and then stereotaxic instruments, which I'm not quite sure what those are, but one is for a primate, and one is for a small animal, and they look like mounting stations that you would mount a head into and then implant electrodes so they couldn't move while you're recording them. It's horrifying. So these are the products right now available from a company out there for anyone and everyone who is doing any type of brain research. They have distributors worldwide, Japan, India, China, and South America. I don't know, guys. This to me just seems like a really horrifying field. Micro electrodes and micro drives, these systems were applied in close cooperation with the Department of Applied Physics and Neurophysics at the University of Maltburg, Germany, where these methods have been used exclusively for 25 years in the laboratories of Professor Reinhard Eckhorn and Professor Reitobach. Well, how interesting that it's German laboratories who came up with all this. As a specialist of microelectrodes for the physiology and especially for the neurophysiology research, we were the first company in the world to develop 4- and 7-core quartz platinum tungsten microelectrodes. So I wonder who their biggest customers are. I don't know, guys. This is not good, as they are cracking every single one of the secrets of the human brain and finding out ways to stimulate, turn switches on and off inside of the brain. This will give them the ability to remote control us with pulses of light or pulses of sound, let's say, to be able to react the way that they would want us to. Here's the basics of optogenetic stimulation in a broad sense. This is out of the National Institute of Health. In a broad sense, optogenetics refers to the use of optical and genetics together for controlling the activity of proteins and cellular functions, or in other words, optical control of the function of genetically targeted or modified cells. Cellular functions that can be controlled with optogenetics include stimulation or inhibition of cells, gene activation, intracellular signaling, and migration. Types of cells that optogenetics can control include neurons, cardiac cells, stem cells, and cancer cells. Well, that's pretty interesting. However, you could turn cancer cells, cardiac cells, neuronal cells, and stem cells on and off just with little flashes of light. However, since the focus of this review is on optics, let's focus on controlling a particular function such as stimulation or inhibition of neuronal cells. Non-specific stimulation or inhibition of defined groups of neurons in brains or peripheral nervous systems by conventional electrical or other non-optical methods has been a major hindrance for applications of stimulation strategies for therapeutic purposes. Of course it is. Furthermore, the study of functions of specific neurons in native circuitry needs to be precise control of activity, which requires dissection to allow accurate positioning of stimulating electrodes. Thus, it has been inherently difficult to perform non-optical, i.e. electrical and magnetic, cell-specific stimulation in live animals. Even with the ultra-fast laser stimulation or light-assisted glutamate uncaging, the problem with selective activation still persists. And emerging methods that combine optics and genetics have scientists speculating about the possibilities of realizing a remote control switch into the brain. Ding, ding, ding. This is National Institute of Health, people. The ingredients for realization of the optogenetic stimulation includes 4 major steps as depicted pictorially. And let me go to the pictor. We have delivery of opsin encoding genes, and then the expression of opsin, and then the light source, which causes the activation of opsin, and then the in vivo analysis, which would be the behavior and the electrical activity, and then the recording of the activity. Synthesis of the genetic construct encoding opsin, delivery and expression of opsin in targeted cells, optical activation of opsin expressing cells, followed by readouts and modification of construct to obtain better optical control. Guys, they are looking at building a remote control for a brain, okay? Now, we read about this earlier today, about them being able to control creating different proteins and phytochemicals that are responsible for flipping switches on and off. Out of the many opsins, which are your light-gated ion channels, we read about this channel rhodopsin, which is the CHR2, is an important photochemical switch responsible for phototaxic natures of algae. Eye spot of the Cladodonimonious rutiteri contains a 7-transmembrane helix protein called the cation channel. The CHR2 is available. Guys, this gets extremely technical, so I'm not going to get into this. How about gene delivery and expression? A second major step of optogenetic stimulation method comprises of delivery of opsin-coated plasmids into targeted cells integrated with the expression analysis using fluorescence imaging. Viral gene delivery provides a convenient and quick approach for media opsin expression. And I thought we had read about them manipulating viruses genetically and putting in Trojan horses with plasmids to go into an organism virally and then genetically modify them. Ding, 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 ding. Future. We're just all going to get genetically virally modified to be able to then react chemically when we have little flashes of LED light, bleep, 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 from our devices and certain wavelengths flashed in front of our eyes. I don't know, guys, but I'm seeing a few dots connecting here. And I don't have enough education in neuroscience or optogenetics to be able to make a call here. But I can tell you that there is something very interesting going on. Besides wavelength engineering, temporal control of light pulses, and that is pulse width, gap between pulses, repetition rate, is required for controlling and probing neurons. Ding, ding, ding. This can be achieved by the use of functioning generators controlling the drivers from the source, which would be either LEDs or diode lasers, directly or by controlling an external electromechanical shutter in the path of the stimulation light beam. For neuronal activation, periodic pulses having the pulse width of the range of approximately 1 to 500 milliseconds and a frequency repetition rate of between 1 and 100 hertz, ding, ding, ding. Remember, your monitors are at 60 hertz, are being used, and the gap between light pulses is decided by the frequency and the duty cycle of the pulses on-off duration. Further, different non-periodic pulse patterns are generated via computer to optically modulate and probe neuronal function. You know, what if they can probe our neural function right through our monitors somehow? And our built-in cameras, two-sided on our mobile devices. This is really frightening. Top of the panel shows schematics of how a typical laser-based optogenetic stimulation is set up. In this case, the stimulation laser beam is the first expanded using beam expander and shutter and is placed to control the temporal profile. The neutral density filter is then placed next to enable the variation of stimulation intensity. The intensity can also be controlled by other convenient means. And why don't we just hand over the whole spectrum to DARPA's Spectrum Collaboration AI Challenge? I mean, we could have AI zapping us at will. Oh, you're getting a little excited there, Johnny. Tune it down a few notches. You know, and this is going to be the new drug delivery, is just by stimulating a few neural chemicals by a few flashes of light. I'm telling you, this is very possible by some of this, what we are reading. For controlling multiple sets of neurons expressing different opsins, multiple colors of activation light beams, and in this case it would be the blue and the green, can be coupled to the same fiber and delivered to the region of interest, as shown in figure one, in the brain. However, certain applications require stimulation inhibition of a single neuron, and in such cases, lasers instead of a lamp can be focused using a lens resulting in a spot size of 1.22 nanometers or something, which would equal 473 nanometers. And the diffraction limited spot size is approximately 4, and I don't know, what does umla and M stand for, which I think is some sort of nano, which is smaller in size of the soma of a neuron. They show a single stimulation using focused blue light. And while focused visible laser beams are very well suited for spatially localized optogenetic activation of cells in 2D transverse planes, the out-of-focus visible light is sufficient to stimulate other opsin-sensitized cells while reducing the axial resolution. And I don't know, this is so technical. But guys, we read some of the key points. The gold standard of neural electrophysiological recordings has been and still is the electrode-based recording and the to measure intracellular current or generation inhibition of action potential by light activation, patch clamp recordings in a voltage clamp or a current clamp mode are generally carried out in vitro, though it can be carried out in vivo as well. Patch clamps work by applying light suction to a cell membrane via a glass or quartz pipette containing a single conductive electrode. The applied suction creates a high resistance seal between the membrane and the pipette, sometimes referred to as a gigaseal, due to the resistance of the seal often being ordered on the order of a gigaohm. And the high resistance seal allows for extremely small currents to be measured by the electrode and amplifier equipment, and the typical optoelectrophysiology setup is shown in the top panel of figure 3. Both upright and inverted microscope platforms can be used for patch clamp recording. So I don't know, maybe they have to do it at a microscopic level. Further, to detect simulation inhibition of neurons by optogenetic activation in vitro and in vivo, single metallic, i.e. tungsten electrodes, as well as an array containing multiple electrodes is used. For in vitro measurements, planar electrodes are fabricated for culturing neurons on them, and the 2D array of slanted electrodes or linear array reaching different depths in the brain is used for in vivo electrode recording. I mean, as we're reading this, we probably can't even imagine how horrifying this laboratory must be that they are creating, and then I don't know if they're implanting them, and then as they're clamping their heads down, do they have really high resolution microscopes that are watching what is going on where these little things are clamped? I don't know, guys. This just doesn't sound like any part of an experiment that I want to be a part of. So under applications, let's see if this gets a little less technical. The advent of neuronal stimulation using optogenetics has enabled highly selective activation of specific neurons within millisecond temporal precision. And in contrast to electrical stimulation and treatment, optogenetics is more specific, and multiple types of neurons can be targeted at the same region of nervous systems. Optical stimulations in general are less susceptible to contamination, and a requirement of mechanical stability is less stringent. The light-assisted method has a higher spatial resolution, single cell or multicellular level, as well as a higher throughput, parallel simulations of multiple cells, wide area, and it eliminates a highly challenging requirement of placing electrodes inside of every single neuron of a specific type. Further, the electrical noise reduction is only required during and in cases of the electrical recording and not for stimulation, which would be unlike electrical stimulation. Selective activation and silencing of neurons by millisecond light pulses has been demonstrated in a cellular culture, brain slices, as well as in small animals sensitized with opsins. These light-sensitive opsins require very low-intensity illumination and can be delivered even from a light-emitting diode, LED. Thus, optogenetics is emerging as a valuable experimental tool since we can all be zapped with LEDs, and a promising approach for intervening variety of disorders such as blindness, drug addiction, conditioned fear, epilepsy, pain, and Parkinson's disease in animal models. Here, due to limitation of space, only one application, and that is vision restoration, will be described to depict one of the uses of optics in various ways. So they can zap you for drug addiction or for conditioning fear in some sort of mammal. Makes you wonder. And here's one more thing. This is a story that came out just a few days ago, today actually, this morning. Light has now been stored as sound for the very first time. For the very first time ever, scientists have stored light-based information as sound waves on a computer chip, something the researchers compare to capturing lightning as thunder. Now, we knew this was all connected. Everything is in waves and frequencies, and if you have a light wave, you have a sound wave, and if you can somehow find ways to translate one into the other, zingo! If you use things such as cymatics, you can then translate them into a shape. It's pretty interesting how it all connects. And then there's all kinds of geometry that comes out of that that is riddled with mathematics. It is all math. While that might sound a little strange, this conversation is critical if we ever want to shift from our current inefficient electronic computers to light-based computers that move at the speed of light. The light-based or photonic computers have the potential to run at least 20 times faster than your laptop, not to mention the fact that they won't produce heat or suck up energy like our existing devices. This is because they, in theory, would process data in the form of photons instead of electrons, just like they had discovered our brains are maybe even doing as well. And we say in theory because despite companies such as IBM and Intel pursuing light-based computing, the transition is easier said than done. Coding information into photons is easy enough. We already do that when we send information via fiber optic cable. But finding a way for a computer chip to be able to retrieve and process the information stored as photons is tough for one thing that makes light so appealing. It is just too damn fast for existing microchips to read. That is why light-based information that flies across internet cables is currently converted into slow electrons, but a better alternative would be to slow down the light and convert it into sound. And that is exactly what researchers from the University of Sydney in Australia has now done. This means that computers could have benefits of data delivered by light speeds, no heat caused by electronic resistance, and no interference from electromagnetic radiation, but it would also be able to slow that data down enough so that computer chips could do something useful with it. For light-based computers to become a commercial reality, photonic data on the chip needs to be slowed down so that they can be processed, routed, stored, and accessed, says one of the researchers of the team. What's even more interesting is if you think back to the beginning phone networks, everything was switched and directed by tone. Do, 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 do. Every time you heard one of those notes, they actually were flipping open a switch and routing your data to go a different direction. I come across a story that I want to find here really quick that sort of looked at some of the energies of the universe. Let's find out where I was. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We can write memories with optogenetics. Where did I just go? Okay, hold on. This is where I always run into troubles because we have so many things. So now we've been able to map sound, light to sound. The basis of the universe, this was out of Big Think, August 27, 2017. The basis of the universe may not be energy or matter at all, but maybe it is actually information. Now let's think about this just for a second. Because if we find out that a lot of the universe is made up of light and different waves and particles, who's to say that those aren't creating some sort of wave that then could be converted to a sound or a frequency that could be then flipped to light? I don't know, guys. Just saying, there's a big question mark here as to some of these secrets that they are unlocking. There are a lot of theories on what the basis of the universe is, and some physicists say it is some atomic particles. Others believe it is energy or even space-time. But one of the more radical theories suggests that information is the most basic element of the cosmos. Although this line of thinking emanates from mid-20th century, it seems to be enjoying a bit of a renaissance among a sliver of prominent scientists today. Consider, what if we knew the exact composition of the universe and all of its properties, and we had enough energy and know-how to draw upon theoretically, we could break the universe down into ones and zeros, and using that information, reconstruct it from the bottom up. This is what the information, the purveyors say it is, and of this view, locked inside any singular component that allows us to manipulate matter any way we choose. And of course, this would take a deity-level sophistication, ding, a feat only achievable by a type V civilization on the Kardashev scale, or maybe an artificial intelligence or a supercomputer. Mid-20th century mathematician and engineer Claude Elwood Shannon is thought the creator of the classical information theory, and though few know of him outside of scientific circles, He's being hailed today as the, quote, father of the digital age. Shannon's spark of genius came in 1940s at MIT when he noticed a relationship between Boolean algebra and telephone switching circuits. Ding, 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 just as I was talking about. Doo, 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 doo. And here's a picture of Claude E. Shannon with his electronic mouse, Bell Labs, 1952. Soon after, he was hired by aforementioned Bell Labs and devised the most efficient way to transfer information over wires. In 1948, he penned a mathematical theory of communication, essentially laying the foundation of the digital age. Shannon was the first to show that mathematics could be used to design electrical systems and circuits. Before him, it was done through expensive model making and mere trial and error. But today, Boolean algebra is used to design communications and computer systems, hardware, software, and so much more. And basically, anything that generates, stores, and transfers information electronically is based on Shannon's tome. And that is not all. Shannon defined a unit of information, a binary unit, or a bit. And bits are serials of zeros and ones, which help us store and recall information electronically. Moreover, he was the first to transform data into a commodity. Ding, ding, ding. Its value, he says, was proportional to how much it surprised the consumer. Ain't that the case? In addition, he connected electronic communications to thermodynamics and what is now called Shannon entropy. Measures the disorder or the randomness inherent in any communication system. The greater the entropy, the less clear the message until it becomes unintelligible. And as for information theory, he developed that during World War II while trying to solve the problem of sending encrypted messages over static-ridden telephone or telegraph lines. And that was when Bell Labs became part of the federal government. To look at information theory from a quantum viewpoint, the positrons, the positions of particles, their movement, how they behave, and all their properties give us information about them and the physical forces behind them. Every aspect of a particle can be expressed as information and put into binary code, so the subatomic particles may be bits that the universe is processing like a giant supercomputer. And besides quantum mechanics, since Shannon elucidated that information theory has been applied to music, ding ding, genetics, investment, and so much more. Science writer James Glick, author of The Information, contends that it wasn't Shannon, but early 19th century mathematician Charles Babbage who first called information the central component of all and everything. Babbage is credited for first conceptualizing the computer way before anyone ever had the ability to build one. The eminent John Archibald Wheeler in his later days was a strong proponent of informational theory. Another unsung paragon of science, Wheeler was a veteran of the Manhattan Project, ding ding, coined the terms black hole and wormhole and helped work out the S matrix with Niels Bohr and collaborated with Einstein on his unified theory of physics. Wheeler said the universe has three parts. First, everything is particles, ding, ding, ding. Second, everything is fields. And third, everything is information. In the 1980s, it began exploring possible connections between information theory and quantum mechanics. And it is during this period that he coined the phrase, it from bit. The idea is that the universe emanates from the information inherent within it, and each it or particle is a bit, it from bit. In 1989, Wheeler produced a paper in the Santa Fe Institute where he announced every it, every particle, every field of force, even the space-time continuum itself, derives its function, its meaning, its very existence entirely, even if in some context indirectly, from the apparatus elicited answers to yes or no questions, binary choices, and bits. A team of physicists earlier this year researched conclusions that would make Wheeler smile. We might be caught inside of a giant hologram, they state. And in this view, the cosmos is a projection, much like a 3D simulation. And what's weird is that the laws of physics operate well within a 2D quantum field, within a 3D gravitational one. It is important to note that most physicists believe that matter is the essential unit of the universe, and the information theory's proof is limited. After all, how would you test for it? Well, if the nature of reality is in fact reducible to information itself, that applies that a conscious mind on the receiving end to interpret and comprehend it. Wheeler himself believed that in a participatory universe where consciousness holds a central role, and some scientists argue that the cosmos seems to have scientific properties which allow it to create and sustain life. Perhaps what it desires most is an audience captivated by its awe as it whirls in prodigious splendor. Most modern physics has hit a wall in a number of areas. Some proponents of information theory believe that embracing it may help us say so the rift between general relativity and quantum mechanics, or perhaps it'll aid in detecting and comprehending dark matter and dark energy, which all combined are thought to make up 95% of the known universe. So storing lightning inside of thunder, researchers are turning optical data into readable sound waves. Researchers at the University of Sydney have dramatically slowed digital information carried as light waves by transferring the data into sound in an integrated circuit or a microchip. It is the first time this has been achieved. Transferring information from the optical to acoustic domain and back again inside of a chip is critical for the development of photonic integrated circuits, microchips that use light instead of electrons to manage data. These chips are being developed for use in telecommunications, ding ding, optical fiber networks, and cloud computing data centers where traditional electronic devices are susceptible to electromagnetic interference, produce too much heat, or use too much energy. The information in our chip in acoustic form travels at the velocity 5 orders of magnitude slower than optical domains. It is like the difference between thunder and lightning, she said. This delay allows for the data to be briefly stored and managed inside of the chip for processing, retrieval, and further transmission as light waves. Light is an excellent carrier of information and useful for taking data over long distances between continents through fiber optic cables. But the speed advantage can become a nuisance when information is being processed in computers and telecommunication systems. To help solve these problems, lead authors, both from the ARC Center for Excellence in the ultra-high bandwidth devices for optical systems, have now demonstrated a memory for digital information that coherently transfers between light and sound waves on a photonic microchip. It was fabricated at the Australian National University's Laser Physics Center as part of the Center for Excellence. Our system is not limited to a narrow bandwidth, so unlike previous systems that allows us to store and retrieve information at multiple wavelengths simultaneously, it vastly increases the efficiency of the device. And guys, if they can go between light and sound, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. All right, guys, make sure you stick around. Today is Monday. Oh, everybody.